Lynn told me we were doing this. just to be clear. Anyway, congratulations, Lynn. Look, welcome everybody. It's terrific to see so many people here. We're expecting about 20 on, so that's all the reshuffling of chairs at the last minute. A couple of things. First of all, toilets. We do have them out there, first left and then second left, and just ask people. Also, there's tea and coffee. We'll talk for a while, and then you're welcome to help yourself to food and coffee. And there's also a little kitchenette out there. If it's more convenient, you can go out there and make tea and coffee and stuff out there. This is very informal. We haven't prepared anything very formal, but we've been doing it for so long we can pretty much talk off the top of our heads about what we're doing. But it's really about what you want from us and what you want to know, and this is a golden opportunity for you to ask us things. So mainly what I'm going to do is introduce the team, and I'm going to spend 10 or 15 minutes telling you what we specifically do here. And then Tina's going to spend another maybe 10 or 15 minutes talking about therapies that are happening all around the world, because we thought that might be something you're interested in. But anytime, butt in and ask questions, or if you want to talk about other things, that's fine. That's what we're here for, just to answer any questions you have. Excuse my voice, I'm just getting it back. So our group, we call the Australian Inherited Retinal Disease Registry and DNA Bank. And we actually only exist because of Retina Australia. They've been funding us at a low level since 1984 and then ramped right up to the funding that they've provided in the last number of years. So on the deck, the six of us, myself, John Durach, and I'll say briefly what everyone does, but everyone does a bit of everything and there's lots of other things. Going from no particular order, Terry McLaren, produces a lot of there we go. As part of it, we're a research group, not a clinical service, but because we actually often genetically diagnose people, but not in a clinical context, we might explain that a little bit more in a minute. That information is very important for individuals to know in many cases. So when our genetics experts feel that they've diagnosed someone or excluded genes, perhaps not actually diagnosing, we'll often send a report to that person's ophthalmologist or genetic counselling service with that person's permission. And Terry, part of what Terry does is a lot of that. We have our two genetics experts here, so they'll be probably answering a lot of your questions, Jen Thompson and Tina Lamy. Jen's been with us about 5 years, Tina's been with us 18 years. And we have Ling. A lot of people know Ling, even if you don't recognise it, because you'll have spoken to her on the phone. Ling does a lot of our recruiting. She'd ring people up, ask them lots of personal questions. And there's one person missing, that's Isabella. She also does a lot of recruiting and admin work and so on. So the six of us, we're located in a department of this hospital, which is Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital. The department is called Medical Technology and Physics, and it does a wide range of many things. We're six people in that department that have evolved an inherited retinal disease register and DNA bank. No one asked us to do it, but it just seemed like a good idea. We started off small, and it's just grown huge. And really, the only reason it grew was because it filled a need. There was nothing. Yes?
Can you just tell me, John, is this only in Perth that you have this particular group?
We're based in Perth, but we do it Australia-wide.
Do you have a similar team working in Melbourne?
No, they don't need one because we do it for them.
Yeah.
We do often get that question asked because it's funny, if something's based in Melbourne or Sydney, no one asks that question. But because we're in Perth, Everyone says, what is the rest of the country? Well, we do it for the rest of the country. So we're an Australian registry. And we didn't start out that way. We started off small, collecting, just making a registry, a list of people who had inherited retinal disease. Was just RP, in fact, in WA back in the 80s. And then it grew and grew, and then Retina Australia as a national body, invited us and funded us significant amounts of money to set up an Australian registry and DNA bank. And so, going back to when it became national, in 2009, all of our DNA was from Western Australia, and now maybe 20% from Western Australia. So we collect it from all over. Okay. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
How many people do you have registered? How
We have nearly 9,000 people on our registry, which is a lot. They're not all affected people. We probably have more unaffected people than affected, because it's very important for us to have DNA from a person's unaffected parents, if the parents are unaffected, so we can compare things and sort things out. And we have about 7,000, of the 9,000 people, we have DNA from about 7,000 people, just under half of whom will be affected. And we estimate that that's about 25% of all people in Australia with an inherited retinal disease. So our DNA bank represents about a quarter of everyone in Australia. So if we could sort out the genetics of all those people, that would be very representative of what's happening in all of Australia, because they're just random from everywhere. So that gives other researchers and people developing therapies a good guide as to what genes to look at and so on in Australia. Okay? Yeah, I'll keep asking, that's good. Except I forgot what I was going to say. Another important point is that myself, Terry and Isabella, who isn't here, we're all hospital employees. Terry and I have particularly been here for many years, and we've done many jobs over the years, but we've sort of morphed into running this inherited or being part of this team. In addition to that, there's Tina and Jen and Lynn. The salary is not paid by the government at all. So that's why we need funding, and that's what Retina Australia mainly and other grants that we get have been sponsoring. But the hospital is very generous. We all have an office, we'll have computers, we have IT people, we have payroll, we have all that. And also they provide, and they pay my salary, Terry's and Bella's, and they pay for a certain amount of genetic analysis. But we also get a lot of money from grants and so on. We also work very closely with Fred Chen, who many of you will know. He's a clinician at Lion's Eye Institute. He's a retinal specialist. He's fantastic. He's very interested in research, and Terry gets about 10 or 20 letters a week from him wanting to know about all his patients and what we've done for them. So he puts a huge workload on us, but we work very closely with Fred, and he apologises he can't be here today. He asked me to say that. So just taking a step... Yes, yes?
Sorry, you just said before that a report sent to the eye specialist after the blood test, you've done the DNA job. I've never received a report, no. So what does that indicate? Because the test was taken about 4 years ago.
Can I address that issue, please? There's often a misconception of what we do. We're not doctors, and we're not a clinical service. Unfortunately, all this isn't covered by Medicare. Genetic diagnosis of inherited retinal disease, there's no Medicare rebate for it. So there are odd hospitals there's various hospitals around Australia who might, or genetic counselling services, who might put a little bit of their budget into inherited retinal disease. So you might hear of someone went to a particular place in Melbourne or something and they were diagnosed. But it's not across the board, and it's at nothing like the scale we do. So we were set up as a research group, but things have changed. We've got about 7,000 DNA samples, and we've been collecting them since 2001. We've analysed just over 2,500 of them. So some people will have given DNA in 2001, and we haven't even looked at it yet. So if you ring us up and say, "What's happened to my DNA?" there's a 1 in 3 chance we'll have even done anything with it. But it is safely stored away. It'll last for tens of years, and we're working through it. It's a matter of money and resources. But we've made huge progress. And in addition to... So we're set up to do research and to work out what's happening with people with inherited retinal disease in Australia, and what genes are going wrong in Australia and that kind of thing, to guide other researchers and so on. But as I say, as a side effect of that, we often diagnose a person, or we very likely diagnose a person. But we don't. But we've produced almost 1,000 reports to people. Now, we're not actually funded to do that. In Retina Australia, when it was all set up, that wasn't the idea. We're not supposed to be a clinical service, and Retina Australia shouldn't be paying for a clinical service. They're paying for research. But as it's turned out, it's become so valuable, and we get that question all the time. People look at us as though we're a clinical service. But you can't send us your DNA and we'll say in a specific amount of time, we'll give you an answer back, like you might do a blood test. You're giving your DNA to us to do research, and you may never hear from us again. Now, that sounds a bit harsh, but we're not like it. We put as much as we can. When we find out what's wrong with a particular person, we report it back to their ophthalmologist. And that's an extra step that's quite time-consuming. Terry pretty much takes all the time doing that, and Tina and Jen are getting things absolutely spot on. So we're not here to provide a clinical service, but de facto we do where we can, because it's not done... I shouldn't say it's not done anywhere else, because it's done spasmodically in different places. But we have produced 1,000... We've given 1,000 results. But you see, the way we operate, because we're a research group, we'll pick particular inherited retinal diseases. It might be X-linked RP, it might be choroideremia, it might be retinoschisis. And so we'll analyse all that stuff, because that's what Retina Australia and others are paying us to do. As a result of that, we find results for particular individuals. And where we can, and where we've got time and where we've got resources, we report those results, and we've reported nearly 1,000 of them, which is huge. I mean, it's an enormous amount of work. And money. It used to be about $3,500 every person we put through a panel. It's incredibly expensive. And when you think we've done 1,000 reports, you can do the sums for yourself. It's a bit cheaper now. It's about $1,000 a panel. So it's very expensive, it's very time-consuming, but we're making terrific progress, but we still can't nowhere near satisfy what all you people want. So, as I say, there's probably, if you've donated DNA, there's probably a 1 in 3 chance that we've looked at it. It's not quite as bad as that, because some of the DNA we have, we'll finish up never looking at, because it'll be family members, and we collect what we can at the time, because we don't know in advance what's going to be useful, but sometimes, okay, we've nailed that one, we don't need to look at brother and sister anymore, or something like that. So we'll never actually look at all the DNA we collect, but we've made huge headway, but there's still a long way to go. So does that answer your question? Why?
Yeah. Just one more.
Yeah.
So it takes time when we donate money to the Lion's Eye Institute.
Yes.
Should we be actually donating some money separately to?
Oh yes, everyone.
definitely.
Yeah,
no. If look, there's so many terrific research projects going around, but we're one of them. Unless you donate, you can donate to Retina Australia, and Retina Australia will use that money for various research projects, and we're one of them. And they generously give to us, but they have other projects as well. If you give it directly to us, then that's what it comes for. So it's really up to you how you want your money spent.
Oh, but I always wondered that.
Yeah.
How it gets dispersed.
For example, Fred Chen. Some people will donate. He got a grant actually, but he has used $50,000 a year for 3 years for us to do genetic analysis on his patients. So that works for both of us, because he's getting information about his patients, we're getting our research information. We still have to provide all the labour to work out what's going on, but we're getting these $1,000 things for free. But anyway, to answer your question, if you specifically want money to go to us, you have to specifically donate to us. The other thing we used to avoid, because we didn't think, oh, just who can afford it to get a result, but because we want to analyse all the DNA we have, now if someone isn't an immediate part of our research, they have something that we're not actually doing as a research project at the moment, if they want their result, we've changed our tune a bit, and we say, well, if you donate money, because it pays for our research assistants at the hospital level, so we can't charge for our services, so we ask for a donation, and we ask for $3,000, and if we say, if you'd like to donate $3,000, we will expedite your thing. It's probably still going to take 12 months. We've got to get out the DNA bank, we've got to send it over to America, comes back, our experts have got to look at it, we've got to produce a report. It'll still take about a year. And you may not get a result. It may come back and say, nothing was found. Yeah. So that is a bit of a change in the last couple of years. We actually, We don't ask for money in that way, but if anyone offers, if everyone says, oh, can I get the result quicker in some way, we'll say, yeah, if you give us $3,000, we will do our best to get the result. But there's never any guarantees with this stuff. So, all right, so that's us. The only other thing I might mention, with all the DNA we collect, so we have a registry, and there is an annual report that comes out every year, and we have a website that you can Google, and you can download the annual report from it. So if you want more detail, or you can ring us up. We're talking to people all the time, ringing us up or emailing us, wanting to know things, and often specifically about their case. In terms of, I think I was going to say, the registry is useful for many, many things, and it's all in here. And I won't go through it all, but it's not just a list of people in there. It's used all the time. And one example is Fred Chen, who's Lions Eye Institute. He's got a terrific team of scientists over there. So what we do, we diagnose eye disease, basically. We try and work out what gene's gone wrong in a particular person that's causing their inherited retinal disease. That's sort of the top and bottom of what we do. Then we disseminate that information, depending on the circumstances, to make it as useful as possible. And one example is what Fred does. If we have an individual that we've found out what's gone wrong in their gene, it's one of Fred's patients, and for many reasons, many boxes are ticked, that patient is high on his list for doing research on. Because we've told him specifically what's wrong, what's gone wrong, he will take a skin sample from that person. Of course, the person's got to agree to join that part of the research. He'll take a skin sample from that person, and then he will turn that skin sample back into stem cells. And as most people probably know, stem cells are capable of then being turned into muscle or bone or anything. But the trick is, those stem cells will have the same genetic defect as the person's got. So this is called personalised medicine. So Fred creates stem cells with a particular genetic defect. My genetics experts will correct me because I'm the layperson. But very broadly, he will take that stem cell, turn it into essentially a retina in a test tube, into retinal tissue, and then he can experiment on that to see if he can fix a problem in the test tube, and then he can test if he has fixed the problem by looking at proteins you express. And if he can, then he's on his way to fixing that in that one person. But that's called personalised medicine. You can see how it's extremely expensive and time-consuming, because that's just for one person. So, that's something that's been going on for several years now. Fred is constantly picking up people who are participants in our research, and also his patients, so the same person, and taking our results and developing personalised medicine. That's just one example. Look, I've probably talked for long enough. Have you got any questions about... Chad?
A question at the time with our retinal diseases or vision impairment. Is there something like any support groups out there?
Support groups and so on?
Yeah.
Retina Australia... Does anyone want to speak to that? Because I'm probably not the best qualified. Lynn, are there support groups for people?
Well, that's what Friends of Retina Australia at Perth, that's what we are starting up, because we were a state-based body, but now it's a national organisation. So it's under Retina Australia, a national office. And so Perth, the Friends of Retina Australia in Perth, basically we're there to support one another through whatever things that we're dealing with, and as well go on a social, have social get-togethers, so we can then talk about things that we want to, on that sort of side of things. So, yeah.
So if anyone is interested in that aspect, they should make sure Lynn's got your email address, and then you'll be included in any emails she sends out for things like this or whatever. So before you go, make sure Lynn's got your email address.
Yeah.
Can I just say, is there a web here? Yeah,
yes,
Erica knows all about different groups to do with vision impaired. You know, there's Vision Blind Citizens Association.
Yes.
There's many, many groups within those groups, yes, et cetera. So that's what you should be also talking about.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Which we will. We'll all be, you know, getting together and, you know, cross-linking all our information so people get to see everything that everyone's sending through. So we try to do that as much as we can, yeah.
Can I just say, though, that there seems to be a huge gap between someone being diagnosed as vision impaired or whatever, and for them to get help. There is a huge, huge gap. You don't go, when you go to your doctor, he doesn't say, well, here's all the things. You just go, you're becoming vision impaired or whatever, and see you later. Yeah. There is a massive gap, and it's very upsetting.
No, we hear that all the time. Yeah. It's very real. It's very real.
And we do want to work on that gap getting narrower, so yeah. That's what we really want to try and work on too with ophthalmologists and stuff like that. So one step at a time we'll get there. Yeah, definitely.
I think things are changing a little bit, because 20 years ago, if you had an inherited retinal disease and went to an ophthalmologist, there would be nothing they could do for you. And so that some were quite brutal and say, nothing I can do for you, go away, and that's it. And I take your point, they could point you towards but now on the horizon there are treatments, and so it's very important if you have an inherited retinal disease, A, to get a genetic diagnosis if you can, but B, to go to a retinal specialist once a year, even if he's not doing anything for you, because when a treatment comes up for your specific disease, he'll have a history of how your disease is progressing. And then they can see if when they treat you, if you're going better or worse than you were before. So it's important now to, if you have an inherited retinal disease, to see a retinal specialist once a year. And if you're not happy with the one you've got, go to a different one.
I would concur with all of what you've said.
Yeah.
And I think that...
Sorry, can you speak up? I don't hear that, Rob.
Hi, Robin.
Hi. Yeah, hi, Rob.
I would concur with all of what you've said, simply because our son was diagnosed with RP in 1981.
Yeah.
He was six. We were basically told to go home.
Yeah.
Nothing they could do. Not him in a blind school.
Yeah.
He'd have no career. And I just wanted to let him know that he's got a PhD now.
Yeah.
He's done
fantastic.
He's done very well. Mm-hmm. But there is support, and it is improving, definitely.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's any access.
Yeah, there is, but...
Any what, sir?
On social media.
Oh.
Where people put a lot of the young ones and
yeah.
Old ones.
Yeah. There are websites for various things like Usher and so on.
Yeah. Anyway, that's...
Yeah. But there is progress. Yeah. Okay, well, any more questions of me? Tina will have a bit of a talk now about what therapies there are around the world. But butt in whenever you want, and if there's other things you want to talk about, we'll just go
ahead. I've got a question just
yes,
on
sure.
The last thing you just said then,
yeah.
That about if you, I've had RP for since 1965 and had lots of research done way back since then,
yeah.
How do you know if your DNA has been analysed? Who do you ring and find out?
Well, you can contact us at any time. Yeah, we have brochures, we have a website.
Yeah.
Can I hand you a brochure?
No.
Oh, okay. So that's got the website as well. That's got the website. Yeah. But there are many ways you can contact us, and we're always happy to hear from anyone, any time, to see what the status is of their DNA. But as I say, there'll be only a one in three chance that we actually looked at your DNA, because we're sort of victims of our own success. There's such a need out there. We don't even ask for DNA anymore, but we still get about 400 or 500 samples a year coming in. And we never knock any of it back. So we just keep banking it. And then when we're looking at particular projects like Usher's or retinoschisis, choroideremia, X-linked RP, then we get all that DNA and we analyse it and so on. But there'll be a whole lot of other stuff that we haven't looked at yet. So, we don't constantly give feedback to our participants, because we take all our time. But we're always very happy to hear from people, and you know, and often we'll say, well, look, ring back in a year and we'll tell you if anything's changed.
So is the genetic eye bank a different thing to this, or has that work been melded into what
you we're not an eye bank. Maybe what you're referring to is where
they called it that, but
when people are deceased, they keep part of their eye.
No.
I know Halliday's. So many years ago, Halliday was collecting retinal disease right. samples. Yeah. We've tried to chase that up. It's
Sydney.
Yeah.
Look, without blowing our own trumpet, we're much bigger than all that stuff. We've got 7,000 people DNA samples, and it's extremely well organised. Because we're a medical physics department, we've got a lot of computing expertise and so on. So we've got really fantastic databases and DNA bank. And the six of us working on it just about all the time. Like, you can't do it as a hobby. It's a big job. You will hear of other DNA banks and so on around the country. And a lot of, they're in good faith, but usually someone's got an interest in it. And it'll be their patients and that kind of thing. But then when they retire, it all disappears. Whereas we're here to stay. We're embedded in this hospital. So when we all retire, the people will replace us. And it'll go on forever. Well, hopefully not forever. Hopefully it won't be needed forever. But for as long as it's needed. Okay, I'll probably bash your ears now. I'll let Tina say a few words.
What I've got to talk to you about today is quite complicated, so just bear with me. So I just want to informally chat about what's happening in the space of the development of all sorts of different kinds of therapies and where we're at with some of these therapies at the moment. So I'm just going to have a quick look at... Okay, so but before I go into that, I think it's important that I give you a little bit of a background about the retina and what goes wrong with the retina, and I'm going to use RP as an example because it's the most common form of inherited retinal dystrophy. So there are about 200 genes, and this is just going to be brief, so just I know it's not too nice for a Sunday morning. So there are a couple of hundred genes that we think cause inherited retinal disease, and the reason that these genes, or when there's mutations in these genes, that it causes a problem is because these genes have very important functions. So they're important to the function or the structure of these cells involved in the visual pathway. So, and the visual pathway is the process by which light is captured in the retina and translated into a message, an electrical message that the brain can understand, and then taken to the brain, and this can be processed as vision. So with RP, we think there are about 65 genes. And primarily, the cells that are affected in RP are photoreceptor cells, and with typical RP, it's our rod photoreceptor cells. So photoreceptor cells are the first line in this visual pathway. So these are light-sensing cells, and they're located towards the back of the retina, and they capture this light signal. And then their job is to translate this light signal into an electrical message that the brain can understand. And there are various layers of cells in the retina. And these photoreceptors towards the back of the retina then pass this electrical message that they've translated the light message into, they pass this message on to the bipolar cells in front, and then these bipolar cells pass this message on to the ganglion cells, and this is really simplified, but in essence this is what happens. And then the ganglion cells, they're incredible really, they extend from wherever they are in the retina all the way through the hole in the back of the eye to the brain. So in this way, the retina is hardwired into the brain. So with RP, there's two kinds of photoreceptor cells. We've got rods and cones. I'm sure you've heard these a million times. So the rod photoreceptor cells are responsible for our night vision and our peripheral vision, whereas the cones provide us with our really important functional vision, which is the high-resolution central vision that you need in the day. So with typical RP, these 65 genes, when they go wrong, typically affect these rod photoreceptor cells. So these genes are important in the function of the rods. So that's why we lose the night vision and the peripheral vision first in typical RP. So if these genes are responsible for the functioning of the rods, then why do we also lose the function of our cones? And the reason for this, it's not directly related to the genetic fault in typical RP. The reason for this is that our rods support survival of the cones. So when the cones go, when the rods go, the cones also die. So this knowledge is important because learning about all of this has given us options to develop therapeutic strategies targeted towards different processes in this disease process. And also it's enabled scientists to develop strategies that can be used to help people at different stages of the disease course. So there are various different therapies. So I suppose early stage, we have gene therapies that can be applied, and I'll go into this in a little bit more detail. Then we have therapies targeted towards protecting the cones, stopping these cones from dying. And then towards the end stage, when there are no cells left to treat, we can use stem cell therapy. And also, there are other therapies targeted towards providing an alternative pathway. I spoke about this visual pathway, capture light, translate it into an electrical message and send it to the brain. So there are other methods involved in providing an alternative pathway. So one is the bionic eye and external technology like that. The other is called optogenetics. And this is really, I think it's really interesting because scientists are working towards trying to figure out if they can provide additional functions to cells that haven't died, so different kinds of cells. So I said before that we've got these photoreceptor cells that die, and they, well, photoreceptor cells that pass the message on to these bipolar cells. These bipolar cells remain there. So optogenetics, something that they're working on at the moment, is trying to give these bipolar cells the ability to detect the light themselves. So we don't need these photoreceptor cells that have lost, thereby restoring this visual pathway and the message gets to the brain. So that's one really quite interesting kind of therapy that's in development. And again, it's more applicable to when we don't have any rods or cones left. So the disease course with typical RP is that the rods get sick and they die, and then the cones get sick and the cones die. So working from end stage backwards, we've spoken about when there's no cells left, we've got bionics and optogenetics, but then we've also got stem cell replacement and reprogramming. So John touched on this before, and it's incredible the advances that we've seen in the last even 5 years. It's these therapies are truly developing at warp speed in the scientific context. So stem cell therapies are really targeted towards replacing these cells that are lost. And so what they've just discovered recently is that they can take a skin cell and deprogram it genetically so it becomes a stem cell. And what they've found is that just by switching on a few genes, I think it's about 4 genes, you can make it become a photoreceptor cell, which... this never happens in genetics. It's never that simple, but they had a win here. So they can just switch on 4 genes and make it become a photoreceptor cell. So the challenge then is, how do you get these photoreceptor cells back in and networked and working? So that's the next challenge. But the reason that this pathway is being taken, because it's important to use patients' own cells. You don't want them getting rejected and things like that. There remains the issue of there still being a genetic fault in these cells, but if you can get these cells back in, these can be reprogrammed with gene therapy. So you just need the cells there to treat. If you can get the cells there, then they can be treated if necessary. So the other form of stem cell therapy, I suppose, in development is direct reprogramming. So the end goal really is to reprogram cells that are there. So our retinal glial cells, they're looking at just switching on and off a couple of genes and turning them into photoreceptor cells. So that would be ideal, I suppose, for those with disease towards the later stages. These kind of therapy is a little bit further away, and which is why I'm working from end stage to early stage, because with the earlier stage therapies, the gene therapies and neuroprotection, these are obviously their forerunners. So working backwards, if we want to save the clones, and really this is one of the most important things, to save the most functionally important vision, neuroprotection is an option here. So neuroprotection is therapy focused on protecting the cells and stopping them from dying, so the clones. And there are lots of different methods, neuroprotection methods in development, focused on the different reasons why we think clone cells die in the absence of rods. So there actually is a potential Australian gene therapy waiting in the wings, focused on neuroprotection. But we can talk about that later if you want. It's not through ethics. Or did it just get through ethics approval just recently?
Yeah.
So, okay, so what I really wanted to focus on was the gene therapies. Gene therapies are aimed at restoring the genetic fault. So in order for gene therapies to be applied, this has to happen while there's still rod photoreceptors left to treat. So the photoreceptors responsible for our night and peripheral vision. So there needs to be something there to treat. And what they learnt from, and there are lots of different forms of gene therapy, and we have traditional gene therapy, which I'll talk about for a minute, but there's also other forms of gene therapy that have just developed so rapidly. So what was I going to say? It was an important point that I didn't want to miss. Anyway, so... I'll just move on. So there are various different kinds of gene therapies. Oh, that's right. Anyway, so our traditional gene therapy, so everyone knows about this FDA-approved therapy, RPE65 gene therapy has recently been FDA-approved. So this is a gene... Let me try and take it back a step. Right. So there are various forms of gene therapy. We have a gene replacement therapy where we can actually put the entire gene back into the eye. And the gene that we put in is obviously the gene that needs to be replaced, the one that's not functioning. And one thing that they learnt from the RPE65 trial is that this has to happen not just when there are rod cells there to treat, but before they get too sick. Because what they found from this trial is that cells that are sick, what we know is that cells that are sick, they start this process called programmed cell death. And once that starts, there's nothing you can do. So they found that they need to apply the therapy before this program is switched on. So this is traditional gene therapy, and there's another form of gene therapy, which is gene editing and various other forms. So recently the FDA approved gene therapy, the RPE65, they treated the first person with this, and this will soon have TGA approval in Australia. So this will only help people with a problem or with an inherited retinal disease caused by this RPE65 gene, but there are loads of clinical trials, human clinical trials, using this form of potential therapy. So choroideremia, they've had successful clinical trials here, X-linked RP, retinoschisis trials are underway. So there are about 40 clinical trials, or 30, involving human gene therapy of some form or another. But this is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the amount of research that's going on towards the development of these therapies. There's so much work going on in developing these therapies in cells and tissues, and then also animal models. All this has to happen before it gets to trial, and there is a huge amount going on now. So we have our gene replacement therapy, which I discussed. This involves putting the whole gene back into the eye. This is really incredible because some inherited retinal dystrophy genes are too big to get into these vectors. So they use viruses, and the best one to use is quite little. And this is good because it can get into the photoreceptor cells and deliver the gene to where it's really needed. But it's bad in that it can't carry big genes. So researchers have just developed a way to deliver or to use this kind of therapy and deliver the gene in pieces and then the genes assembled on site. So this, they've had really good success with MYA7A preclinical studies. It was success, and this is a gene that's primarily it's responsible for USHA1, a form of USHA1. It was successful in mice, and even more importantly, in the USHA context, in pigs. But I won't go into why. That's more important. And also, Livia Carvello here in Perth has also developed a multiple kind of vector technology for another gene, and that's gone to trial in animal models. So all of these are just moving forward. So this is really good news for people who have mutations in really big genes, ABCA4, USHA2, the most common USHA gene. And there are also other forms of gene therapy underway that are at clinical trial and lots of work happening. And I was going to talk about them, but I don't think I will because it's just too much information. But what I can say is that the trials for gene editing, the gene editing is really good because it means we don't have to worry about the size of the gene. So basically, I will talk about the method because it is fascinating, and I hope you can find it fascinating. But what scientists, just 5 years ago, scientists had the idea that they could use these molecular scissors used by bacteria to target invading viruses and chop it up. Only 5 years ago, they had this idea that they could genetically engineer this to target any DNA sequence, so in our genome, target it, cut it at a specific site, and edit it. 5 years ago, and now this technology is at human clinical trial. So I think this is just incredible. And the good thing about this is that we don't have to worry about the size of the gene. This can be applied to lots of different kinds of mutations. And it is, I think there are gene editing trials underway for the most common mutation in USH2A. And what we found is that, let me just make sure that I've got the right therapy on this, but we found that this is also the most common mutation, yes, it's correct, the most common mutation in our population. So this is really good news, because if this can get to trial and get through, then we can hopefully help people at early stage disease with USH2A, this most common USH2A variant. The other gene being targeted for this therapy that's at clinical trial is the rhodopsin gene, and they're targeting a particular mutation that's really common in the American population. But what we found is that it's not common in our population. And this is a perfect example of why it's really important for us to characterise our population. We need to know which therapies we should be moving forward with that are going to help our people. And there's another form of therapy which masks the mutation at clinical trial and lots of preclinical trials. So lots of work happening in animal models. CEP290, it's a gene that causes LCA. And again, USHA2A, the most common RP gene and also the most common USHA gene. So I think the take-home message is there's not a one-size-fits-all approach to therapy, and there's good news in that therapies are in development targeting all lots of different processes and lots of different stages of disease. So this is good news for everybody. And it's really rolling along now. Finally, you probably want to know what's happening in Australia. This is all good and well, but how does that help everybody here? And I suppose what I should say is that there are centres being set up all over Australia, here in Perth, Sydney, Melbourne, South Australia, possibly also Queensland, for this purpose. I know that Fred Chen is working towards developing this centre so that we can roll out, hopefully, trials for choroideremia and X-linked RP. These are all on his radar. So that's, in a nutshell, where we're at with therapies. And I know that was a lot of information to take in a really short space of time. So if you've got any questions, just ask, and I hope I haven't overwhelmed everyone too much.
That's good. I have got three questions. With the therapy, you're talking about the FDA.
Yeah.
Once you've targeted those genes and you know which one needs to replace, how are you actually going to get it into the eye?
Oh, this is such a good question, and it's something I wanted to talk about, but I didn't have time. Yeah, I'll repeat the question. So the question was, once we know the gene and that's at fault and that there's a gene therapy for a particular gene, how do we get this gene into the eye? And we use viruses to get this gene into the eye, and there are lots of different kinds of viruses, but there's one that's really, really good that I was talking about, and it's called AAV. And so what happens is that you hollow out all of the viral DNA. You don't want to get any of that. You don't want to be delivering that into the eye. And instead, you put the gene in that you want to be functioning in the eye. And you also put with it other elements that means that when that gene goes into the eye, it gets turned on in the right place at the right time. And that's critical. So these viruses get injected into the eye. They're little. They make their way to where they need to be. The viruses release the gene into the eye. And because they've got these extra elements, when the cell says, oh, we need this gene, they prick up and they cause this gene to produce a protein which can perform its function and restore function in that way. So that was a long answer. But
how do they know where to go?
That's a really good question. And we're in the field of genetic characterization, but not in... I don't work specifically in delivering the gene therapy, but these viruses end up everywhere, really, I suppose. But they're only switched on in certain cells, which is why these other elements are really important, because in photoreceptor cells, it will be switched on. And in other cells, it won't be switched on. The other really important thing to know is that these modifications, they're not inherited. They can't be inherited. We're not changing the DNA in the eggs and the sperm. It's happening in the eye. So that means that a child who inherits the problem, if they haven't done pre-implantation genetic diagnosis and so forth, will also then have to have the therapy. With gene replacement therapy, it's one injection. With other forms of therapy, it's continued injection because of the nature of the therapy.
Also, it stays in the eye tank, doesn't it, because it's isolated.
Yeah, yeah.
And can I just add to that, too, that that's why a lot of these therapies are trialled in animal models, and that's why we have human clinical trials, because you can't say, all right, we think it's going to work, let's, you know, try it on 5,000 people. It has to be highly regulated, and that's why clinical trials take a number of years. I know it's probably frustrating for people that want the therapy, they want these clinical trials to hurry up, but it's really important that it's done safe, in a very structured and safe manner, and shown to be doing what you want it to do and not doing what you don't want it to do.
A clinical trial is an experiment on human beings. It's not a treatment.
Yeah.
It's an experiment to see if it works.
And the first method of that is safety and efficacy. Is it doing what we want it to do, but even more importantly, is it doing stuff that we don't want it to do? So you start with small numbers of people and you try it on them, and once you get that efficacy, then you start to look at what's the right dose that we might need to do. So it's really involved.
And I should say that the choroideremia trial is well advanced in that context, past all the safety aspects. It's effective. They've done dose escalation trials. So by the time they get here, they'll be in the later phase of the trial. But I think it's important to know that they are still trials and things could go wrong. I think that depends on a number of factors. Oh, sorry. So the question was, does the therapy improve the person's eyesight or just stop further degradation? And I think that depends on lots of different factors. It can improve eyesight. Some of the people that were involved in the RPE65 trial, their eyesight did improve. It probably depends on how many cells are left to treat and a number of other factors. So, yeah, it's early days really in terms of figuring out And it will be gene specific in many cases. Different genes will have probably different levels of efficacy.
Yeah. How long will it be, or how far off?
Yes. So the question is, how long is it going to be? I think it really, that's hard for us to say. Things are moving really rapidly, but it also depends on the kind of therapy that might be applicable to you. What gene has gone wrong in your case? So, for example, if you have Leber's congenital amaurosis and it's due to the RPE65 gene, then when we get TGA approval in Australia and these clinics have been set up, then they can be treated. So for them, not long at all. For other people who have problems in genes where the trials are advanced, obviously longer than the one that's already been FDA approved, but you're talking, I don't know, 5-10 years maybe.
Carotidemia is on the way.
Carotidemia is definitely on the way. So, but it's hard to give a timeline because these things also have to go through ethics approval and in Australia, and it's difficult to say. But it's just a few years, I suppose, for some genes, for some forms of therapy, and longer for others.
Yes. So how do we know that a possible trial might be applicable to their unique condition? Is that up to our eye specialist?
So that's a good question. So there are clinicians spotted around Australia, and there are gene biotechnology companies and pharmaceutical companies who are developing these trials, and they contact these retinal specialists, there's just a few, Fred Chen's one of them, saying, who have you got that might be suitable for this? And Fred will come to us and say, who have you got who might be suitable for this therapy? And we never give out details or anything like identifying information, but we know who has variants in particular genes, which individuals might be candidates for certain therapies, and we can say, we think we have 50 people within this age range who might be candidates, and if they're happy and things proceed, then we'll be able to get in touch with our participants and notify you and say, there's this therapy, this is their information, if you're interested, get in touch. And that's the idea.
I'm a patient of Dr. Chen, and one of the things he mentions quite often is a CR1 gene. What sort of research and therapy is being done in that area?
CRB1. Also, do you know what therapy is going on in CRB1? I can't think of anything on CRB1 off the top of my head, but that doesn't mean to say there isn't. Jenny and I, we're like ducks. Like, particularly Jenny looks calm on the surface, but we're paddling like buggering. So there's so much work. We've got so many balls in the air, and it's hard for us to remember off the top of our heads what's happening. But if we get contacted by Chen or a company, we can easily source that information and pull up the info. So sorry, but
I think they definitely, I can't think of the exact therapy, but I know Fred often is talking about a lot of work being done.
I did mean to look it up before I came.
I don't think there are actually trials yet, but certainly a remedy. I think he's working.
I think most of the more prevalent RP genes, there'd definitely be work going on, but the status of it in terms of preclinical or clinical trial, I can't remember off the top of my head. Yeah,
but I can say that that's being looked at in terms of how to take that person's skin cell and turn it into a stem cell and then move it along into a retinal cell. And this
is patient-specific. We just wrote a paper.
This is patient-specific. So the outcome of that research was to look at a person's individual changes due to changes in the CRB1 gene. And it's a recessive gene, so these changes occur on both copies that you have. You get one copy from mum, one copy from dad. And in this gene, you have to have two pathogenic changes for it to manifest disease. And one of the stages that we were looking at with Fred was taking those cells from the patient, turning it into a retinal cell, and looking at what actually is happening in that cell. because the focus here today, I guess, is on what gene causes your condition, but there's a lot of work that goes into that.
Can everyone hear me now?
So with Fred, we're looking at patient-specific changes in that gene because people want to have clinical trial therapies, they want to have gene replacement, but it's really important that we actually pick the right faults that are causing the disease. So that's another element with all this gene therapy, is to be able to look at this in a dish and say, we think that this is what's causing disease in that person, is that correct? And you can actually look at the changes in the cell, see what protein is being produced by that gene, and we might think that it's faulty, but it might actually not be. And we use a lot of information to come to a decision as to whether we think those changes are pathogenic or not. But it doesn't replace actually looking at it experimentally and saying that's the cause. So I can tell you for CRB1, that is being looked at the moment from participants that we have in the registry.
Can I just ask a question? My husband was diagnosed with macula when he was 40. He's now 72. But then further on down the track at the eye clinic, there was a Swiss doctor who was seeing them. At that time, it was on a 2-year-old titrate. And then he found that what he was looking at was, because he'd obviously done some research on retinitis pigmentosa, that was now retinitis pigmentosa. He went through some testing, I think it was through the department. But it still hasn't categorically been ruled out. Is it similar to macula, retinitis pigmentosa?
So RP can manifest in lots of different ways, and it can be really difficult for clinicians to give a definitive diagnosis. And what many of you have probably found over the years, your diagnosis may have changed because it's difficult for them to really, in some cases, really figure out what's going on until the disease has fully revealed itself. So I know that for some of our X-linked RP people, macular dystrophy has often been an early diagnosis, and then this has changed and finalised it.
She's the only one in his family, except for his mother, but she was in her late 70s when she was diagnosed with macular
damage, right, okay,
which was an age-related.
It could be, yeah.
But he was 40 when he was first diagnosed
by 40.
Professor.
Yeah, it's very complicated, and it's
okay. So it's not they're not similar in any way, really. As far as they said, the diagnosis still the same, that your central vision and eventually your
peripheral. So like a cone rod dystrophy. So we have patients in the registry who've been diagnosed with a macular dystrophy, or their query macular dystrophy, and they end up with a diagnosis of cone rod dystrophy, but we're not clinicians, we're scientists.
It's not that uncommon. I don't want to give the impression it happens a lot, but we'll have a clinical diagnosis from an ophthalmologist, and then we do our genetics. Find out it's not that at all. And the genetics is pretty, that's it kind of thing. Yeah. So then we'll go back to the ophthalmologist and he'll reevaluate, he or she will reevaluate the diagnosis.
Yeah, it was quite most of the morning that we went were under these tests. Every time we go every year, they say, we still don't really know, but we're still putting you down as retinitis pigmentosa.
And I think it's also important to note that everyone sits on a spectrum. And you might not necessarily exactly fit that box, but that doesn't mean to say that you're not. That you don't have that condition with some slight differences. So I suppose we can think of ourselves as I know for Usher syndrome, for example, there's Usher type 1, type 2 and type 3, but people fit anywhere on this spectrum in between these types. They still have Usher syndrome, but perhaps it depends on other genetic changes that they might have which impact on that mutation or affect how their disease manifests. I wish it was simpler.
Yeah. Well, with macula, I think it's more the central, isn't it? So
the macula is central vision.
Now he's losing his other.
Right. Yeah, so cone rod dystrophy. In the past is called atypical RP.
So retinitis pigmentosa, I think, was first used and it's like typical retinitis pigmentosa when the rods go first and then the cones.
Yes.
But then sometimes it's the central region first,
yes,
cones and then rods. But I think that came on, that was called atypical retinitis pigmentosa. Sometimes it's, so it's a form of retinitis.
Yeah, but it's like the reverse.
So now the tendency is to drop those kind of terms and use a more specific rod cone dystrophy,
okay,
or cone rod dystrophy. But in the past, they've been more or less both called retinitis pigmentosa, but one was called atypical.
But ideally, what you really want is a genetic diagnosis.
Yeah. Yes.
Because all that other stuff is good to classify people and look at prognosis and so on. But really, your disease is caused by what gene has gone wrong, or what's gone wrong in that particular gene.
Yes.
So every one of those is, in a sense, a different disease.
Different disease.
There's thousands of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Chad, do you want to say something? Sorry?
David Bowie. Do we know what David Bowie is?
I've never had that question before.
I didn't know he had one.
Because he had one blue eye and one brown eye.
Oh, did he?
Ah, did he? I don't know. Doesn't sound like a retinal disease.
No. He's not a participant. And if he was, we couldn't tell you anything.
Interesting.
No,
just to clarify, the lady in front of me whose husband had macular degeneration, now they're saying RP. If she got, and her husband got a DNA, could they then say definitely?
No. No, may not make that clear. We attempt to do a genetic diagnosis of people. So if we take the lady's husband's DNA, we can send it off to a place in America.
Yeah.
They do this genetic analysis. We get the results. Spend hours, days, weeks, sometimes looking at it. At very roughly, about 60% of the time, we can say yes. We're pretty sure this variant is causing the disease. About 40% of the time, we still don't know.
Right.
So it's not always definitive,
right,
but when it is, it's more as certain as you'll get.
Okay. So it's more
or less
that in you.
Yeah.
One of those.
In relation to that question, where if the gene is found, then yes, you're likely to say, able to say that gene is associated with rod cone dystrophy or typical retinitis pigmentosa. Or it's actually associated with the macular dystrophy.
And
so the gene result will tell you that.
Okay. I was more thinking about his children down the track,
okay,
because they always look for macular degeneration when they go for the eye test. But
yes,
it'll likely be known what type of inheritance that gene is associated with.
Right.
And then genetic counsellors will be able to advise on the type of risk associated with each.
Yeah, whether it's
different
recessive,
vulnerable,
or X-linked.
Okay, right.
That is a very important
thing.
Because
if
it's recessive, it's far less likely that
We're finding there's always exceptions to the rule, that genes that are known to be recessive, you'll find a surprising case where you think, it actually looks like it's dominant.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, it's not always super cut and dry.
John, I think in summary, we've always had the question, we all know what RP is, we all know we've got it, we know it doesn't work. Our question's always been the same, that is, how soon can we fix this? Now that's been answered. Fred's answered it, the prof used to answer it, the prof said anything's been done anywhere in the world, he said, I'll be doing it in 3 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we know that, sitting on top of it. Fred's answer to that is quite simple. He said, it's a breakthrough.
Yeah.
You can have a breakthrough on your particular genes, and we can do it instantly.
That's
he said that breakthrough month next week.
Yeah.
Like 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
We waited 40. We know it's all happening.
Yeah. But Jen pointed out, that because everything has to go through clinical trials, you can't just... Everything takes... Like, it might be some 6 people on a clinical trial for 5 years. You've got to wait until it finishes before the next day, so that's why it takes so long.
But it's getting quicker.
Yeah. Someone said, like, penicillin, when they discovered penicillin, it was 30 years before they injected anyone with penicillin.
Well, it was 20 years for the RPE-65
trial. It's the complexity.
Professor
Marshall came over many years ago, and he said, to find a gene that is infecting your RP, yeah. is finding a misspelt word in a set of encyclopedias.
Yes.
That's the bad news. The good news is we're not only in the right volume, we're about three paces yeah. away.
Well, our job is to find what's wrong, and it's all these other things that Tina's explained. Other people all around the world and next door are attempting to create treatments and therapies.
Yeah, based on
but,
that.
But what we do is the very first bit, which is absolutely necessary. First of all, find out what's gone wrong in your eye. And we're very successful at that, but we still haven't
that is getting better.
Got a hit rate of 60% or something. Yeah.
And I have to say, too, that the ability to find that three-letter word yeah. in a dictionary, that the ability and the technology to do that is really moving along as well.
Yeah.
So a lot more cases are solved now than they were 5 years ago.
It's a global scene. Communications, once upon a time, you might be working in isolation. But as the prof used to say, he said, if they discovered something in Germany, he said, 3 days later, I could be doing it.
Yes.
It's right now. You don't need to travel. You don't need to do it. It's all there.
And it's probably come across, but it's incredibly complicated and brilliant science that these people are doing. It's amazing what they're doing. Putting a gene on a virus and putting it in your eye.
Yeah.
And that's old school gene care.
Yeah. So it's real. Absolutely cutting edge.
And so when John says we send DNA off to America for a panel, that panel at the moment now looks at 577 different genes. So that's why we're not across what every single gene does in the eye, because we've got 577 that we deal with. That's just to find those changes in that person that we think might be causative for their disease.
It's a good point. I mean, we've gone forever here talking about it. But there's about 25,000 genes in every cell.
Mm.
And there's about 500, because they're the ones with a really high hit rate of causing inherited retinal disease. So that's 500 out of 25,000. There could be another one, but we don't know about it. But it can't be that common, otherwise it would be known about it. So most people who have an inherited retinal disease will have something wrong with one of those genes. The other thing I should mention, which we haven't, but probably most people understand, we don't do age-related macular degeneration. That's a totally different field. Our participants don't have that. It's mainly RP and many other things. Listen, we can stay forever, but people might want a cup of tea break, or if you want to leave, that's fine, but if you want to hang around, we'll stay. What do you want to do?
Well, I'd just like to say thank you for such an informative talk, even though it was just pretty informal. I don't know about you guys, but I feel so motivated just by listening to the enthusiasm of this panel. And I just want to say thank you. And yes, please feel free to have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, because John said we can stay.
Yeah.
It's his fault.
As well as here, there's a kitchen around there that you might find more convenient for the hot water.
Yeah, and I'd love to catch up with you all and come around and have a chat. And thank you all again for coming. And thank you guys for giving us such an insight. It's so exciting.
Thank you. And if you want to have a discussion, we'll see you.